welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians and social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Now time to move on to what I think is going to be one of the most special parts of the evening, and that is to hear from Sister Linda Yankoski. Sometimes I have the opportunity to introduce speakers that I've heard about and have a lot of respect for based on their work and the impact that they've had on the community. But sometimes I'm given the privilege of introducing someone that I also know and admire just as much for who they are. Just as much for who they are as a person, as well as for their work. Sister Linda is just one such person, so I'm particularly glad to be able to do the introduction tonight. Sister Linda Yankoski has been with Holy Family Institute since 1975. Holy Family has a combined budget of over $40 million, nearly 750 employees, and provides services designed to meet the needs of children and families in the Pittsburgh area, my home territory. Sister Linda is active with many professional and community organizations and serves on a number of boards, including Duquesne University, Sister's Place, and is chairperson of Families International. She graduated with a bachelor's degree in social work from the University of Pittsburgh, a master's degree in administration from the University of Notre Dame, and an EDD from Duquesne University. Her research interests include nonprofit history and administration, religious identity, and organizational theory. Among the many accolades in Sister Linda's career, she received the Champions for Children Award from the Homeless Children's Education Fund in March of 2004, the Manifesting the Kingdom Service Award from the Diocese of Pittsburgh in 1999, the Carlo Woman of Spirit Award in 2001. In 1998, Sister Linda was featured in Success Stories of Pittsburgh. She's a graduate of the Leadership Pittsburgh Institute and received Catholic Youth Association Award in 1997. In 1994, Sister Linda was honored as the Vectors Woman of the Year in Religion and was named Volunteer Administrator of the Year in 1993. I won't go on. I hope that just gives you a flavor of the contributions that Sister Linda has made in her work and in the field. But to tell you the kind of person Linda is, I should mention that just recently I found out that she stepped down as president and CEO of this organization with a $40 million budget. She did it so that she could become one of the primary caregivers for her aging parents. For those of us who've been in social work for a while, to be in a position of that kind and then to voluntarily step down to provide services to the people that raised you is a great indication, again, of the kind of person that Linda is. And for those of us who know her, completely consistent with her priorities and values as a woman of deep faith. So therefore, it's not just because of her work, but also because of who she is and the way she lives out her faith in her life that I'm delighted to welcome as our guest speaker tonight, Sister Linda Yankoski.
I won't stay up there. These are no longer an option. These are required. Thank you so much, Rick, for that very warm and very generous introduction. And yes, I think I was really touched as well by the letter of the president of the board of the association as he talked about being one in the sandwich generation. But I am continuing to work part-time at Holy Family Institute. My new title is Chief Strategy Officer Institutional Advancement. Real fancy for fundraising. So, but, you know, they gave me a nice title and I agreed to do it. Now, you talk about getting the short straw. That wonderful music presentation, then to hear about all the stuff that you should be out there doing. And now you're going to sit here and listen to me talk a little bit about how to move from mission to mission effectiveness. So I'm going to do my best. The good news, I was telling myself as I was sitting here thinking about having to come up here and speak after all that, is that this is a group of Christians in social work, so you have to be nice to me. I mean, You have to be nice. So let's begin. My presentation this evening will consider strategies that enhance mission. And I'm not changing the slides myself, so we're going to work this out. Elena, please change the, thank you, change the slide. In developing this presentation, I relied on two sources, and so I want to give those to you now. And there are some handouts on the back table of this presentation. I don't think I brought enough, but I think Rick said he'll put it up on the association website for anybody who wasn't able to get one if they're helpful to you. But these are the sources that I used. McKinsey and Company conducted case study when we need to think about the organization itself. You can change the slide, Elena. So the role of capacity building is to do more to improve the lives of people that we serve. We have an obligation to seek new and ever more effective ways at making tangible progress toward our mission. And this requires building organizational capacity. Both board and staff need to think early and often about strengthening the organization in lockstep with implementing programs. A food bank that improves its inventory management, for example, will deliver more food to more people and more quickly. Change the slide. But there are barriers to capacity building. Managers and boards and staff, especially us staff, we tend to favor program work over back office work or even higher order functions, such as strategic planning. We tend to focus on creating new programs and keeping administrative costs low instead of building the organizational capacity necessary to achieve our aspirations effectively and efficiently. Capacity building has a business ring to it, and often we don't like that terminology in our faith-based organizations. Donors and funders have traditionally been more interested in supporting an exciting new idea than in building an organization that can effectively carry out the idea. It does take time and money, and often there's a lack of knowledge about how do we go about increasing our technology, or what are the opportunities for better strategic planning. But this must change. Both nonprofit managers and those that fund them must recognize that excellence in programmatic innovation and implementation are insufficient for us to achieve lasting results. Great programs need great organizations behind them. So let's look at the elements of capacity. There are seven. There are three higher level elements and three foundational elements. These elements are all interconnected. It's possible to target any one of the seven elements to improve or build organizational capacity. However, the case studies that McKinsey reported on suggest that any effort to build capacity in one element will impact another. But there isn't, most organizations can't attack all of them at once. You'd go crazy. Holy Family Institute, the organization that I continue to be involved in, is right now in the process of a capacity building. We are adopting a new treatment modality and training modality for all of our staff and all of our programs. So we're going to take 750 employees through similar training, whether you're an office worker, a childcare worker, a teacher in a school, a social worker, or an administrator. Everyone's going through the same training. And it's changing a lot of our systems because of targeting one element to build capacity in our organization. Let's look at these a little closer. Elena, you can switch the slides. The three higher level elements, aspirations, include mission, vision, goals, and purposes. Aspirations inspire our staff, volunteers, and donors. Some of the organizations in the case study had done was they included outcomes in their mission and vision statements. Take stock of children, if it still exists here, but it's a Florida mentoring program, they changed their vision to decrease the Florida dropout rate by 1%. So that would align all that they did. That new vision statement, by putting an outcome in there, suggested that this is how staff would be evaluated, how they would evaluate their programs and services, and they would have a marker of where they were going. Second Harvest. They changed their mission statement from feeding the hungry to creating a hunger-free America. What that caused them to do was to focus more on advocacy, and so they're as their main service, as opposed to their food pantry. And by doing so, they generated more federal monies for food banks across the United States. Aspirations are the basis for strategy. And more than the sum of an organization's activities, good strategies build on an organization's core competencies, allocate resources to priorities, and help delineate the unique point of differentiation. It's whether we're a nonprofit or we're a faith-based organization, we want to collaborate with others, we will collaborate with others, but we also compete. And sometimes we compete against other faith-based organizations in our communities. That's just the way it is in delivering services today. Capacity-building efforts that focus on the strategy component have typically sought to align an organizational strategies with its aspirations. And all of these aspirations or strategies depend on the organizational skills. For many high-performing organizations, the most important component of the value chain is the process through which they develop, implement, fund, and measure programs. So, mission success draws on the full range of an organization's skills. Now, let's take a look at the three foundational elements. These are ones that we typically spend time with in our organizations. Human resources, the staffing levels, the directors, the CEO, the senior management team, and staff have appropriate competencies. And sometimes when that doesn't happen, we build capacity by changing or hiring for it. But it includes also our board members, the composition of the board, their commitment, their involvement and support, and our volunteers, their capabilities and reliability, because at times we need to enhance that component in order to build capacity. Systems and infrastructure. Systems are processes, both formal and informal, by which we get things done. Infrastructure describes the assets that support the organization, both physical and technological. Usually, the faith-based organization's ethic of make do with what we have is often at work here. There are strong possibilities for our organizations to add value in this area, just as with systems, but we know, again, this takes money. Then let's move now to the next element. And this is, I believe, the most essential element, and that's culture. Culture binds the organization together and includes shared values and practices, behaviors and norms. And most important, the organization's orientation toward performance. Culture is an underlying current throughout the entire subject of capacity building. Culture holds the organization together, and because of its pervasiveness, is difficult to change. And the culture of an organization, the culture of a department, the culture of a school, the culture of a family we're trying to help, you can take this from the large organizational level and you can drill it down to any small grouping, any small unit, in terms of the culture you want to change. Two aspects of culture, its core values, beliefs, and behavior norms on the one hand, and its performance orientation or performance culture on the other. Building a strong values-based culture or building a strong performance culture is a strategic, intellectual, spiritual, and often difficult process. I would like to turn now to the role of leaders as change agents. The concepts apply to leaders at any level, whether you're a leader in a department, a leader of an organization, the leader of a youth group, leader as a change agent trying to establish change. And if we could go to the next slide. I would like to use this painting of Christ's entry into Brussels in 1889 as the basis for discussing leaders as change agents. This might be a pretty interesting picture. I hope it is. I hope you can see it. The subject matter is a crowded street scene, herd-like masses of modern society. Ensor's society is a mob. It's crude, chaotic, somewhat dehumanized, not very pretty. One has to look hard to find Christ in this confusion. Shouldn't Christ be at the forefront leading the parade? Shouldn't he be the visual focus of the painting? After some searching, you will find the Redeemer in the background, a little to the left of center, almost lost in the throng of revelers that threatened to engulf him. He's got a halo on. You might be able to find him. In all previous versions of this biblical scene, Christ riding on the donkey into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday to a tumultuous welcome, Christ is the subject. He leads the parade. He is front and center. We are accustomed to seeing Christ depicted as king, at the head of every public manifestation, at the top of the hill, even in death. O'Toole interprets Ensor's work this way. Christ who visits Brussels must compete against the manifold distractions of modern times. In Ensor's painting, not a soul in the crowd pays a centime's worth of attention to the one who would be their savior. And that condition could be a pretty fair assessment of the starting place of all would-be leaders, change agents in modern societies and organizations. In Ensor's time, secular democracy was taking root in Europe. Ensor was making a statement about the atheist social reformer Emile Littré. He's wearing the bishop's mitre, kind of leading the parade. Ensor understood that social chaos would arise from the secular democracy that was taking place. 100 years ago, he saw the seeds of the tradition-destroying trend that would eventually produce, among countless other cultural horrors, 175 channels of cable TV, 75 brands of cereal to choose from. The painting forces the viewer to think about the unprecedented obstacles to effective leadership in a world that has grown in the subsequent century even more turbulent than Ensor's frenetic Brussels street scene. The sources of resistance to leadership are more varied and more numerous in our modern pluralistic democracies. On this score, Ensor saw that henceforth leaders would face the challenge of having to lead without the traditional powers of station, sanction, the threat of suppression. Instead, like Christ, leaders would have to appeal to the minds and hearts of their followers. So if we agree to view Christ's entry into Brussels in 1889 as a comment on the dilemmas of modern leadership, we may profitably employ the painting to focus our attention on an extremely practical question. How can any leader overcome the powerful forces of resistance to change? How does one preserve human dignity and worth in doing so? Let's look again at the painting. How can anyone lead from the middle of an inattentive crowd of individualists, each a political and social equal, and every last one bent on demonstrating that fact? Now, I don't know about you, but I think a whole lot of folks that I work with tend to be very individualistic. Let's assume Christ's leadership goal was not just to enunciate his central teaching, love thy neighbor as thyself, but to actually win converts to his cause, starting with as many Belgians as he can convert. But he finds himself alone, powerless, confronting a multiplicity of self-interested agendas in an amorphous crowd lacking any sense of discipleship. Where and how can he begin? Traditionally, there are three generic answers that are given to a question on how does a leader affect change. A leader can command, manipulate, or paternalize. Let's take a look at these three approaches. Can change be commanded? Realistically, what would be the effect of Christ demanding that all Belgians love one another? About as predictably futile as a family member ordering a loved one to stop smoking. For even when it is clearly in our own self-interest to obey a command, we all bristle when told what to do. Can leaders achieve change by manipulating others, using staff members as a mean to the organization's ends, telling people what they want to hear, fudging the facts a little? Would the people of Brussels ever again trust Christ once they learned he had lied to them? Or can change be shepherded? While the image of Jesus as the Good Shepherd is attractive, this philosophy of leadership too has become antiquated. The old line, "I'm making you take this medicine for your own good," is not well tolerated by today's employees, or probably by our clients. Today, few people tolerate being paternalized or maternalized. Today, I like to think about Jesus as a good shepherd going out after the minority report, seeking out the unique, seeking out the different. While these three models are distinct, they have in common the all-knowing leader who is wiser than the collective followers. Another very popular approach to leadership is contingency theory. You know, it all depends. All depends on the circumstance. Effective leaders do what the circumstances require. For example, when there's a crisis or chaos, the leader's temptation is to conclude that this is one of those tough times I've got to be tough. Or the leader needs to ride in on a white horse and save the situation. Situational leadership is ineffective in the long term. A contingent leader who acts tough even once will be seen as inconsistent, thereby destroying the trust that is essential to win people over to change. O'Toole talks about a Nassau experiment in his book, where Nassau had three-person crews in a simulator to find out how the captain could make good decisions. And when they were presented with a crisis situation in their simulator, the pilots reacted in one of two ways. The captain either issued an immediate command regarding the situation, or some of the captains consulted their co-pilots. They said, "Holy cow, what should we do?" What they found was that the pilots who took charge were less likely to arrive safely. The pilots who asked for help had a better record. Now, again, often we might argue, well, there's no time to get input. In the simulation, they recognized that they had actually 30 seconds to make the right decision, or they wouldn't arrive safely. And they found that it took about 5 to 15 seconds to get advice. So even in a high-powered, high-crisis situation, asking for advice can help. So there's cause to challenge the essential wisdom. Is effective leadership, in fact, a morally and behaviorally relativistic act? Or are there some basic moral guidelines that are constant and non-contingent? Let's take another look at Ensor's painting. What strategic and philosophical courses are available to Christ that are both practical and moral? Christ must first start with the people closest to him in the crowd. He must get their attention. not by talking about himself and his personal values, beliefs, and ambitions, but by listening carefully to what the potential disciples say they need and want, what they aspire to, and what they value, by demonstrating respect. Christ not only listened to what was being said, but he was able to hear their deepest aspirations, their underlying needs, that even the person speaking might not be able to articulate. Remember the woman at the well. Christ offered a vision that transcended immediate wants, yet at the same time, he encompassed these in a higher order view of the common good. All moral and effective leaders so illuminate their followers' better sides, revealing what is good in them, thus ultimately giving them hope. This hope, this transcendent vision of a new Jerusalem, encompasses the followers' needs and aspirations, yet it is a better place than they could imagine on their own. Let's take a look at the opposite. Can we imagine a situation in which Christ would be successful in winning over the crowd by being tough, disrespectful, and unconcerned with their needs? How far can he get by ordering them to love their neighbors? Leadership does not depend on circumstance. It depends on the attitudes, values, and actions of leaders. Let's change the slide. James McGregor Burns describes moral leadership this way. Moral leadership emerges from and always returns to the fundamental wants and needs, aspirations, and values of the followers. I mean the kind of leadership that can produce social change that will satisfy followers' authentic needs. I mean less the Ten Commandments than the Golden Rule. But even the Golden Rule is inadequate, for it measures the wants and needs of others simply by our own. Let's change this slide. Effective moral leadership is always and at all times focused on enlisting the hearts and minds of followers through inclusion and participation. We must put aside the notion and instinct to lead by push, particularly when times are tough. We must adopt the unnatural behavior of always leading by the pull of inspiring values. So what moral absolutes do we hold as leaders in our organization? Moral absolute. Example, slavery is always wrong. Can you ever think of a time when slavery can be justified? It's a moral absolute. Any violation of human rights is always wrong. That is why rape is always wrong. Preserving human dignity and worth. Let me change the slide. Respect for the human dignity and worth for followers is made manifest by listening to them, faithfully representing them, pursuing their noble aspirations, keeping promises made to them, never doing harm to them or their cause. So let's take a quick look at the lessons learned from the case studies in terms of organizations that were in the process of developing their organizational capacity at any level of the organization, whether it was the systems or the infrastructure or the people or culture. Effective capacity building is rarely confined to addressing only one of those elements we talked about. Addressing one will invariably lead to making changes in other elements. So for this reason, capacity building requires leadership. The second lesson, I think we can change the slide. Okay, the second lesson is that in the act of resetting aspirations and strategies, often the first step in dramatically improving an organization's capacity. The nonprofits in the study that experienced the greatest gains in capacity were those that undertook a reassessment of their aspirations, their vision of what the organization was attempting to accomplish in the next phase of its development, and their strategy, and how their culture supported the change. The third lesson is the importance of good management. Nonprofits need people in senior positions who are committed to taking the initiative to make capacity building happen and are willing to own it. Progress in effectively resetting aspirations and strategy, institutionalizing sound management processes, and improving systems to work at scale requires managerial ability as well as leadership. Many organizations discovered they needed to hire a chief operating officer, somebody who could focus on the day-to-day while the executive director was busy about doing some of the other fundraising or idea-generating activities in an organization. And the third lesson is that you must have patience. Almost everything about building capacity in nonprofits takes longer and is more complicated than one would expect. It can feel like a never-ending process because improvements in one area or practice have a way of placing new demands in other areas and trigger new needs. There are quick fixes when it comes to building capacity. And both managers and those supporting them need to acknowledge this up front and set expectations accordingly. So, to conclude, treating people with dignity and respect is what moral leadership is about, and nothing could be harder. Right. Those days are gone. So thank you for your attention. I don't know if there are time for questions I'd be glad to. Thank you. There are a few minutes for questions. I'd be glad to take some. I know it's probably been a long day for you. Yes, please. Well, yeah. I think for any faith-based organization, did everybody hear the question? The concern about hiring individuals for the organization who might not share the organization's values because you're not sure you can bring people in. Well, I think that any faith-based organization has a duty to hire people for mission and for your religious identity. And I think that we have every right to ask individuals before they walk in the door if they can support this mission. Here's our philosophy. Doesn't matter what tradition they are, what religion they practice or they don't practice, but they should be able to say that, yes, I can promote your mission, your philosophy. I can work within it. Because we have every right to hire for mission. We have to ask questions in a way that doesn't discriminate. But there isn't anything discriminatory about asking somebody to come on board with our mission. So I think that hiring for mission is really very important. And now, in my organization, we have mission and identity meetings on a regular basis every month for all supervisors who work with all staff throughout the organization. And we focus on those missions, on those meetings, our values, our identity. We look at the church's social teachings. We look at our founders' values. And we really, it's a formation program. So we do things like that encourage the values in the organization. But I think it's imperative and important to do those kinds of things. The first point in our job description promotes the mission and philosophy of the organization. And we have some behaviors and attitudes, and we write it right under there. And we call them on it. I mean, I think you can, and I'd be more than glad to share samples of our hiring or our job descriptions with you. Okay, well, thank you very much for your attention. I hope you have a wonderful week. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for NECSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to ethically integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NECSW activities and events, such as NECSW's upcoming convention 2011 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from October 20th to 23rd, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NECSW members, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NECSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NECSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening into our podcast session today.